the great cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a great cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the great cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible, at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Grey Cricketer Podcast. My name is Ian Higgins. I'm joined by Dave Edwards. Dave, hi.
Hi, Higgins. I was just waiting for you to say and Sam Perry, but Sam Perry is not with us this week. That's because he's on assignment in Melbourne.
He's on assignment.
And the reason for that is because he's going to be interviewing Christopher Rogers, Chris Buck Rogers, one of Australia's great test cricketers, will be joining us. Via the Melbourne Fox Sports studio this week. We look forward to that interview very much.
Looking forward to it. But you know what, Eddos, you and I are not missing out because we get to talk to Ryan Carter's Sydney Sixer, creator of Batting for Change, the wonderful organisation, and all-round nice guy, I must say. I'm thoroughly looking forward to that, and I hope you are listener too. Dave, big show this week.
Double header.
We're going to talk about Australia-Pakistan. We're going to be previewing the Boxing Day Test, the second test, Australia v Pakistan. India and England, that series is wrapped up, and of course the Big Bash kicked off last night. I do remind our listeners we record on a Wednesday evening. Last night was Tuesday night. You are listening to this on a Thursday. I'm telling you what you're doing in your life. How lonely are you?
Yeah, took her for a drink on Tuesday.
I'm joined by Craig David. Dave, let's talk about Australia-Pakistan. The test match finished up. It was a day-night test match at the Gabba, and Australia almost lost the unlosable match, but wasn't it awesome?
Mate, it was an absolute ripper, wasn't it? I was just on social media the other day, and weren't Cricket Australia licking their lips over the outcome?
Yeah.
I saw that the head of CA Digital was basically salivating over their engagement figures on Twitter. You know, the amount of the viewership and the engagements they had towards the end of that test, on the fifth day, no less.
Yeah.
You know, to be fair enough, there's nothing better than looking at online engagement stats and then thinking of exciting ways to monetize that data. I've always said that, and you'll back me up on that, he goes. But it was a great test, wasn't it? And what a thrilling finish.
Yeah. I mean, Twitter analytics aside, for those who don't know what happened, perhaps our international listeners don't know what happened, but Australia set Pakistan an imposing 490 to win with about 2 days to bat. And Pakistan, they did their best. They hit 450. That's one of the highest fourth innings totals in the history of cricket, albeit in a losing side. They got close. I think the last two wickets fell in the space of about a run or two runs. Asad Shafiq's got 137, a wonderful 137 in the fourth innings. I mean, they got so close, but it was all too much in the end. On the fifth day, Stark took the penultimate wicket, and then Steve Smith finished a test match with an exciting run out from first slip. If that's not the most Pakistani thing ever, hitting 450 in the final innings and then getting run out from first slip.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is.
After getting absolutely rolled in the first innings and us questioning why they're even here on tour. Is this the worst Pakistan side ever? We're rating them out of 10, zeros for all of them. Mate, no one knew what was going to happen at the Gabba. You'll remember, Higgos, we were all talking about the humid conditions and what the pink ball would do. Day five wasn't doing much.
It really wasn't doing much. Nah. I mean, the whole test match was hinged basically on Australia sending Pakistan into bat at night on the second day. And geez, it looks real hard to bat at night, Dave. I don't know about you. I'm sure Nick Madison will back me up. He's facing reverse swinging Yorkers from Rabada. But
a lot of heart from the Pakistan team.
A lot of heart.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people have also been talking about the decision that Steve Smith made to not enforce the follow-on, something that's kind of been de rigueur for the Australian team ever since that VVS Laxman-Dravid partnership all those years ago, still burning in the memory of all current and former Australians.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts on that decision? I mean, I know in this high-performance year of cricket, it's important to give the bowlers a bit of rest, a bit of respite, especially with Pat Howard at the helm, all that kind of sports science and analytics and so forth.
Yeah.
But do you think it was a misstep by Smith?
No, I don't think so. At the end of the day, they almost got 490, and that would have been like I was WhatsApping you and Sam throughout, as you recall, and I was saying, "Geez, I hope Pakistan win because I think it'd just be awesome."
Yeah.
And also, there's something about Australia's alpha aggression which just annoys me, and I just love Pakistan. I love the West Indies. I love Pakistan, and I've said this many times, but I think world cricket is strong when they're winning. So
something like masochistic about it, like watching how desperate the Australians were getting towards the end of that. Like you could see in their faces, the anguish and the agony they were going.
Australia is a Bond villain. and yeah. you want them to, like, as much as you are born in the Bond villain family, and you want them to succeed, ultimately you want James Bond, i.e. Pakistan, to defeat them and kill them in a painful manner.
007 analogy.
So, I don't know, Steve Smith's decision. Like, these bowlers have played a lot of cricket, Dave, and they're only going to play more cricket. So, I think they need as much break as they can. Yeah. There's talk about, Australia resting some players for the Boxing Day Test match. They've got a week in between tests. That feels like enough. But, yep. I mean, in our era growing up, this wasn't as big a thing in the UK. But in Australia, certainly, like, if you were an age group bowler, you could only bowl 14.6 deliveries per hour.
Yep.
You know, there was all these weird regulations and, like, obscure
wrapping
scientific
youngsters
numbers
in cotton wool.
Yes, yes. And so this feels all very similar to that. So I don't know. Like, at the end of the day, we won the test match, but it was close.
There were playing great cricket. A lot of jokes when a 15-year-old would come on into his second over. Yeah. Take him off, he's done. Restrictions, stress fractures, cotton wool.
Dave, I want to ask you about the run chase itself. So there was a lot of criticism about the way Pakistan went about it, because there was a lot of, like, slog sweeps. Now, being very aggressive in chase, and the Channel 9 commentators, although maybe a bit harsh to critique them, you know, although saying that, given any chance. But like, what they wanted Pakistan to do was just to block it out, just negate. But there's been...
Have they never watched a game that Pakistan's been in?
Yeah, well, there's that as well, yeah. I mean, the arrogance of not knowing a guy who's played 51 tests in Asad Shafiq, who's got 137. Yeah. The arrogance of them...
7 or 8 tons.
...boasting that, like, they knew nothing about him is quite astounding. But, I mean, that aside, they wanted Pakistan to, like, just negate, just leave lots of balls go. Don't play any reverse sweeps.
No.
Don't be aggressive. But no one has ever chased 490, so, like, and everyone gets bowled out in the fourth inning. So if you keep doing the same thing over and over again, surely you're likely to do the same thing and be bowled out. So I was loving that they were just teeing off.
Yeah.
You know, like, Asif was just, like, just bombing them over cover. Amir,
and,
not Asif.
And weren't they doing it with a smile on their face
as
well?
That.
It was just really refreshing to see. They were clearly enjoying being the Bond villain. Or, no, sorry, you were saying they were the James Bond, weren't they?
Yes, yes.
Oh, okay, I've got the analogy mixed up. But they were certainly relishing in Australia's discomfort, I felt, which was good.
Yeah. Nathan Lyon, the love-in for Nathan Lyon. Can we talk about that just for a few minutes? I mean, like, it's, to me, there's something about it and the whole nice Gary thing. I mean, but yuck. Then every time, yes, yuck, correct. But every time Nathan Lyon touches the ball, it gets, like, this kind of, like, Bronx cheer. And, like, it all feels a bit insincere, the love-in for Australia's greatest ever finger spinner.
Doesn't it? I saw a bloke wearing a nice Gary shirt as well at the Gabba. You know, so obviously they're monetizing his brand image now and his catchphrase, which is taking on a whole new life of its own. Look, I don't think Australia, the team and the public, take Nathan Lyon seriously enough.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I think that's the issue. I mean, his skipper doesn't bowl him for a start.
Yeah.
Not getting any overs.
Yeah.
So he's just kind of becoming the guy in the team who everyone likes, but they're not threatened by him.
But even, like, being referred to as GOAT, like, greatest of all time, even that's kind of, like,
sarcastic,
no, like, sarcastic. You're not actually greatest of all time. Yeah. Well, statistically, you are, in fact, the greatest finger spinner Australia's ever produced. And, like, there's only been two spinners in the history of Australian Test cricket, Dave, who's taken more wickets than him: Richie Beno, Shane Warne. But we're still taking the piss out of him.
I think he's just got to get rid of that nickname, however he does it. I'm not sure. I mean, it's kind of like when you get a pet nickname, you know, in your grade cricket team, or maybe even your girlfriend or whatever. I mean, I remember we had a listener DM us about a situation he was in where his girlfriend was nicknaming him Boof. She was American, didn't know that it was the nickname of Darren Lehman, and he wondered, what do I do, guys?
I recall that. Yes, I recall that.
You know, he should just, you got to start getting people to back. You know, GOAT is a good nickname, greatest of all time. I think he should be trying to redirect that and maybe get some more prestige back, because nice Gary is a stock lame catchphrase. And it's just not doing him any favours.
So if I can return to our own experiences, Dave, you and I played a lot of junior cricket together. We played some representative cricket together when we were younger. And we played in the...
Weren't we good?
We were so good back then. You were. I was just part of the team. Because my dad was manager. No, he wasn't. No, I made that up. But
never came to any games.
No. But we played in the guy, and we just... We nicknamed him Teeth because he had big teeth.
So literal.
So I mean, we should caveat that with we were 15 or 16 at the time. Should have known better, sure. Yeah. But I mean, so
physical traits should never be picked on.
Yeah. So I don't know what he should have done to avoid a nickname the same way that you're suggesting Nathan Lyon should.
Well, I think he's a fitness model now.
Yeah.
So that could, maybe that's what Nathan Lyon could do. Instagram.
Let's quickly talk about the second test match, Dave. Dave, who's Hilton Cartwright?
Well, it's a question on everyone's lips suddenly, isn't it? He goes, yes. It wasn't on my lips yesterday, but today it certainly is.
Heard of him. No.
I don't know, mate. I don't want to learn about any new cricketers. No. I've already had to do that recently, and it was arduous. It was time-consuming. I had to learn about Renshaw. I had to figure out, you know, the life history of Hanscom and Mandelson. Now I've got to learn about Hilton Cartwright. I mean, sure, he's a great player.
Yeah.
And, you know, a cursory look at his stats shows that he's probably good enough to do a job. They want to bring in a batting number six. So Mitch Marsh doing all right with the ball, not enough with the bat. So that's obviously what their thinking is there. The selectors have been clearly galvanised by the success of Renshaw and Hanscom. Not a lot of success by Mandelson, but, you know, 66%. Chance or 67% success rate is good enough. Two out of three, good enough. I've always said that.
Meatloaf said that. two out of three. Out
so are the Australian selectors. So they're taking a punt on this guy. Not sure if he'll get a Guernsey, but I mean, you've done a bit of research on him, haven't you?
Well, there was a story went up about him, and just obviously because he's a new player, so we have to delve into his entire family history. And there was a story come out. His family of tobacco farmers were forced out of Zimbabwe by the Mugabe regime when he was about 7 years old. Cartwright has made his life in Australia and is now set to wear the country's famous baby green cap after impressing selectors with a first-class average of 44.5 and an ability to hit the deck hard with his part-time medium pace. Nice. Obviously, I'm reading that. But I don't know. Judging,
that's the Mugabe regime. They've got a lot to answer for, don't they? First Pocock.
Yeah.
He's a former Zimbabwean guy who used to do great things.
Yeah.
And I think Colin, the great man, Grandhom, over in New Zealand, he's a former Zimbabwean as well.
Yeah.
So now this, you know, Mugabe's iron fist has cost Zimbabwe a lot of sporting success.
Yeah, amongst other things, of course. I don't know, I mean, like, we're just trying to find 2005 Andrew Flintoff.
Yeah.
That's all we've ever done. That's what Shane Watson was. And Shane Watson, you know, to be fair, had a stellar career. And whatever you think of Shane Watson, he was an important cog in the Australian team for a long period of time. And now Australia, without him, are struggling to replace him, basically.
Yeah.
And Mitch Marsh had his struggles. There's obviously the suggestions of James Faulkner as well. Maybe that's a thing. He's done very well in the one-day attempts. Different beast, test match cricket. There's Moses, obviously, Moses and Reeks.
It's a great time to be a middling all-rounder.
Yeah, it
is. There's no better time. I mean, I wish I was around then. That's exactly what I was, a middling all-rounder.
I just want to know why we have to try and find 2005 Andrew Flintoff. Yeah. Like, because he just revolutionised Australia's perception. Like, Australia's perception is that Flintoff won that Ashes by himself, and we're still rocked by that in many ways.
Like we're rocked by the VVS Laxman and Dravid partnership all these years later. We don't recover well, do we?
We recover very poorly.
Mental scars.
Rocked to our core. I mean, this whole thing feels very much like, I mean, Australia's involvement in the $200 million project to find Lost Flight MH370, which we just have discovered that we have no idea where that is. And
similarly,
we have no idea where the 2005 Andrew Flintoff is in Australia. We've got no idea where it is. But
it's somewhere off Reunion Island, I think, washed up there.
Dave, just really quickly, the Big Bash has started, and we're excited by that, aren't we? We're excited about the Big Bash being here. That means Christmas around the corner, means exciting new colours, seeing great players who retired from international cricket a number of years ago still getting that one big payday. And we like seeing that because it's home comfort, isn't it?
Any little home comfort I can get these days is greatly appreciated. I love the graphics package they've gone for as well. I'm not sure if you caught that. Very dynamic. It's good to see new commentators, fresh faces.
Sure.
It's also great to see cricket on a new network.
Yeah.
And I think a great part of that is getting to see the ads on Channel 10.
Yeah.
I don't watch a lot of Channel 10 these days, although I hear that Waleed's killing it on a lot of issues. But one interesting thing I saw was that some of the ads for Neighbours, Toadie's ex-wife, who they got married and then they drove off a jetty into water and she was presumed dead, but apparently she's back.
She's back?
Yeah, Toadie's wife is
bombshell.
Back. So, I know our UK listeners are probably following the Toadie ex-wife storyline, you know,
more
given
than
their
the big
affinity
bash.
With Neighbours. More than the Big Bash. Exactly. So tune in after the Big Bash to see what's happening on Ramsey Street.
Well, I think we've just got the title for this podcast. Dave, we will touch on England. We're sort of running out of time to fit in this segment, but we will touch on the series that's just finished over in India. India versus England. It was a whitewash. England lost the fourth test match in the final session on day five. England hit 477 in the first innings. You're thinking, we're in a pretty good position here. Then India replied with their highest ever score in international cricket and scored 759 for seven declared. Karun Nair, playing his third test match, just hit 303 not out. Wow.
Yep.
I mean, I'll ask you a question, Dave, in that there's been a lot of reaction to from Australians in that we think we're killing it because we beat Pakistan at home when they almost chased down 490, and we're just reveling in England losing to India when we're going to go there in February or March and we're going to get absolutely dominated.
We've talked about it in the podcast before, but isn't it just shaping up as one of the greatest shellackings in international cricket history? When Australia goes there, I mean, we've got a bit of time now to formalise our team, you know, to see who we're going to take on this tour. But it's coming around a little too soon for my liking. I feel like we might be in for a bit of a show over there.
Yeah, I mean, one of my big things taking away watching, I haven't watched any extended period of time, but I watched the highlights.
You don't have Foxtel.
No, but Ravi Jadeja is the greatest player to ever play cricket in India. He wouldn't play fourth grade in Australia. is rubbish. Yeah, like some of the wickets that he's like some of the balls that he's getting wickets from are just like if you play in Australia, he's getting wickets from like half trackers, half volleys, just spinning like hitting the splice, half trackers just keeping low, spoons mid wicket. It's weird. He is unplayable in the subcontinent. Anywhere else, he is village.
But he's used to playing on dust. He's grown up playing on dust bowls.
Grown up on dust bowls.
And we've grown up on beautifully curated wickets and lush outfields and wonderful pavilions with nice tea spreads.
Chris Rogers coming up.
I'm generally away during the winter, so I have the entire summer to spend at home watching cartoons with the kids. And I really love my OLED TV. Like, really, really love it. One of the things I look forward to most when I come home is actually to be able to sit down on the couch in front of my OLED TV and just say the word OLED repeatedly. I really like saying the word OLED. I'd never heard it before, this paid commercial, but I enjoy the way it rolls off my tongue, like some kind of exotic Spanish word. OLED, OLED, OLED. It drives my wife nuts, but the kids love it. And
LG OLED TV. OLED. You'll hear it 1,000 times this summer. So go on, try saying it 1,000 times too.
Edo's Pez is on the line. He's called in. He's from Melbourne. Nice of him to join the show in spirit and on the phone. Pez, hi. How are you going?
Hi. Good. This is weird.
Yeah.
It's weird that you're not here, not only because you're not on the podcast, but you won't be joining us in the post-podcast showers.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's the thing I'm going to miss the most. That's what everyone says.
I've got no one here to hold my hand, both figuratively and literally.
Well, the reason you're not here, Pez, is because you're down in Melbourne. We're giving some love to our Melbourne listeners, aren't we, this week? And you've got a pretty special guest on the show.
Yeah, a lot of people writing in saying that we don't show Melbourne enough love. So I stayed down. That's not why I stayed down, but I'm down here. And I was lucky enough to get an interview with Chris Rogers, of all people. So, yeah, we went into the studios in Fox there. It was a really small studio as well. I think I refer to that in the interview. But it was really, really small. And then Max was in there, the sound guy as well. Anyway, great interview. Great guy. I was a little bit giddy about the whole thing, to be honest. I gave him a lift home afterwards, and I got home and I said to my wife, like, Chris Rogers was in your car. He's famous. And then I realised how silly I sounded.
Most famous person you ever had in the passenger seat of that Nissan Pulsar.
Yeah.
Did you clear the Solo bottles out of the back, out of the passenger seat?
Yes, syrupy Gatorade bottles. Yeah. It was a good interview, though. I enjoyed it.
We look forward to it, mate. And we might throw it on now. So here it is, Chris Rogers with Sam Perry.
Well, it's a very special pleasure on the Great Cricketer podcast. As I sit in this like strange, very kind of like, what are we talking about here? Like it's a claustrophobic room. We've got the sound guy Max in here, and I'm also sitting here with another legend of Australian cricket. So the guy I'm sitting with played 25 tests, just over 2,000 runs, highest score of 173. Let's just define him by numbers. Average of 42.87 to the second decimal point. 500s, 1450s. But let's talk about the first class record as well. 313 matches, over 25,000 runs, high score of 319, average 49.55, 76 hundreds and 122 half centuries. Chris Rogers, a real fall from grace to be on the Great Podcast.
Nah, thanks for having me, Sam. But luckily, it's only you and me today, isn't it? It's a bit smaller than you.
We always ask, like, we always say the same thing when we kick off these interviews. And I've heard some stories about you as well, so just be prepared. But what is your relationship to grade cricket?
Well travelled, I think. I've played for five grade cricket clubs over my time, three in Perth and two in Melbourne. When I first came to Melbourne, I actually played for Essendon, but was living in Prance on the other side of the river. And then I found out all the Prance guys were going to the College Lawn Hotel on a Sunday afternoon. So that was good enough for me. But actually, I became a life member at Prance Cricket Club after a few years. I think I'd played 19 games and averaged 29. this night we had a presentation night, and I got this award with David Hussey, Bryce McGain, and a club legend, Neil Schlittler.
A friend of the account, actually.
Yeah, Schlitz, he's very funny himself, isn't he? And I felt, I felt out of place because all these guys had played a lot for Pran. So I went up there and really wanted to give this nice speech about, how much it's meant to me and how good these guys have been. They've been my mates in Melbourne and stuff like that. And I said, this award just means so much to me. Got this big round of applause and then walked off. Completely forgot the award, left it up on the podium. So, I'm not sure how well that went down.
Well, you've alphaed the life membership, really, and that's what you should do if you've played Test cricket for Australia. But, I guess, Chris, I always talk about being, earnest on the show. I'm the only one who does it. But, I admire you because, and I don't mean to be sycophantic about it, but, you seem to, unlike so many other cricketers, almost any other cricketer, you traverse the whole cricket scene really gracefully. You are a bona fide test player who achieved greatly for his country. You also retained a connection to, club cricket, and obviously your first class career is almost unrivaled. Do you hate cricket?
No, I don't know. I like cricket. I love cricket, but I liked the lifestyle even more. That was the thing. It just kept me out of a job. So it's been some great times and you just meet so many people and that's been the best thing about it. So a lot of people say it, but your best mates are your club cricket mates.
Yeah.
Not so much the guys that you play professionally with, because that kind of you go up there and players come in and out, but great cricket, it seems to be the same blokes for a long period of time.
Mm. And so you're still, let's talk about your club cricket side, right, Paran. That was a good side. David Hussey, Bryce McGain. Did you play with John Moss? He was there as well.
No, Mossy was just before me, actually, but when I came over, I heard he was a legend of the club. We had a good side. Even Dimitri Mascarenhas, the ex team. I remember when we had the whole side together and we got hammered by Fitzroy in a 2020 game. So, but it was more the social side. I just remember my mate Charlie Burke, who I was living with and now runs kind of Hong Kong cricket, was playing and in the twos, really. So I would kind of finish up at Essendon and come over and end up socialising with the Prang guys, and there'd be 25 guys out, It was just this incredible club.
Yeah.
I just loved it, so I had to move there.
So, let's talk about moving clubs, right? This is Chris Rogers talking about changing grade clubs. That's a big thing in grade cricket. Did you literally play for Essendon, saw the social side of Paran, and said, I've got to be there? I just want to be at the College Lawn.
Probably or not
did, someone
far
say,
off.
Did someone say like, oh, there's 5K in it for you?
No. It was as much having a drive across town at 5 o'clock in the afternoon trying to get to Essendon training. I lost interest in that. So, I think grade cricket is as much about the social side as anything else. These guys are playing because they enjoy it. They like hanging out together. And that's not to say Essendon wasn't fantastic as well. There's still some guys Scotty Bryant and Craig Berger, that I still hang out with. So it was probably as much the geography as anything.
Mm, okay, and then let's just wind back a little bit. We talked to Gideon Hay last week and took him back 70 years and then pushed him forward another 100 years and stuff. So there's nothing linear about this. But you grew up in Perth, right? And was it in Perth? And did you play a bit of grade cricket there, or were you just always in the under 19 systems and stuff like that, and gave it a wide berth like Brendan Julian?
No, I've been listening back to the podcast. I feel a bit under pressure. They've been outstanding. So, BJ was very funny, I thought. And he actually, that story about when he retired was one of the best things that happened to me, because when he retired, I got his contract. So that worked out. Good on you, BJ. But when I was picked in the state under 17s, I was the leg spinner batting 10, and Dave Hussey was the off spinner batting 9. So I kind of wasn't really, you know, the flavour, and had to do it, you know, go through the grades, played at Melville, and then Dad actually said go play at uni, because he played at uni in New South Wales, and they won a couple of premierships, and he said it was the best years of his life. So I went there, and that was excellent until the coach basically told me that it was the flattest wicket in Australia, and that I wouldn't make it as a batsman unless I moved. So then I was forced to move, and I went to South Perth and had some great moments there. Darren Waits is still one of my best mates, and it was good times there as well.
I mentioned earlier that you kind of traversed the cricket scene, but like, you're close with a lot of guys that are playing in the national side now. You're not long out of it yourself. It's probably hard to generalise about the whole side, but like, what connection to grade cricket do you think they have? Do you think that connection to the club that they're from is increasingly disconnected, or do you think that a lot of them still feel an affiliation with it?
I can only talk from a bit of what I see in Melbourne. I still think there's love for it. You know, I still see, I went down, I kind of said I'd help St Kilda do a bit of coaching down there, but I've only been down there once. But you know, Petey Hanscom's still heading down there.
He loves it.
I think so. I think the guys still love going back to their roots. The good thing in Melbourne too is guys play juniors somewhere else, then come play grade cricket. Mm. But then when they finish up at grade cricket, they go back to their original club, and that's actually different to what happens in Perth. But there's just this kind of affinity with where they grew up, where they played, and it's great to see.
This is a special show in the sense, I mean, you were talking about Melbourne, like, this is a special show in the sense that I've decided not to go to Sydney this week. You've moved to Melbourne, and so it's a little bit of a Melbourne special. You know, tell us, and we've got a lot of Melbourne listeners out there, you know, what is your relationship to Melbourne? You live here now, you've moved over from Perth, obviously not been tempted by the, you know, bright lights of Sydney. And I've heard you like bright lights as well, but we'll get to that later. what does Melbourne mean to you?
Oh, I think Melbourne's one of the best cities in the world. I've seen a few, and it kind of suits me. I've got red hair and freckles, so the sun, you know, I'm not sure I need to be on Bondi Beach. but probably suits me a bit more here, Chapel Street. I don't tend to venture too far, but, I guess when this opportunity came up to come to Melbourne, it was a bit of a no-brainer, and being fortunate, you know, met so many good people and been well looked after, and it's kind of all gone well since that happened. But I kind of think I know where you're going to go with that next question, but grade cricket in Melbourne is the most amount of sledging I've ever come across, and I've told this story quite a few times, but I remember playing my first game against Fessenden against Fitzroy, and I remember batting, and I was copping it from everywhere about, and they were all talking about how I'm not fit to tie Bobby Quiney's shoelaces, and then all these kind of things. And there was this
like specific sledge, isn't it?
Yeah, there was this little 17-year-old kid with this kind of flock of blonde hair. At point, Rory Bremner, I'm led to believe. We've exchanged a couple of messages over Twitter, but nice ones, I'll have you know. Yeah. And he just kept saying, this bloke's got no idea. I remember I was just
Chris Rogers has no idea.
I just remember looking. And it was in his
ball.
It was in his first game. It was his first game. I thought, what a little legend.
That's good. Yeah. That's almost the ultimate way to alpha someone, though, is to kind of like appraise their sledging, even if it's directed at you. Yeah. So you think Melbourne grade cricket sledging is worse than anything you experience at any other level, and you have played every other level?
Oh, without a doubt. It's like, and I said it again, they play it like it's AFL. They're all wannabe AFL players. So even selection on a Thursday night, you can be there till 10:30 at night. I'm like looking at my watch going, what is going on here in Perth? You're done by kind of 8 o'clock.
I think
see you later.
I think it's the same with Sydney. Oh, actually, I actually want to do something deeper on this. But that's in like in a different life. But like I played with, lucky enough to play with Graham Rummins at St Kilda.
Yeah.
And he, I'm from Sydney. He pulled me aside once at St Kilda training and said, like, look at this. Everyone just wants to pretend they're from AFL. Yeah. And like, you know, talk about life members. He's one of the legends of that club. It is funny how like really cricket here is just an expression of AFL love, right?
Without a doubt. You can see, you know, even kicking the footy in the morning, morning the game or before training and all that kind of thing. They all think they could have been top 10 in the AFL draft. Yeah.
So I'm going to connect grade cricket with your Test career, and you did so many wonderful things in Test cricket, right? We understand that, but like there was a moment when you were playing in the Ashes where, and you might be able to fill us in on this, but you were dismissed and someone was in your eye line. And there's a connection between that and grade cricket. Can you fill in the rest of that story?
Yeah, I remember I was 84 and in Old Trafford, third test, and on the verge of my first century, and I hadn't done very well in Test cricket by this stage. It was my fourth test, and all of a sudden there's this kind of commotion, and they'd actually turned the square around at Old Trafford, right. So they had it point in a different direction, so. All of a sudden, this stand, which previously had anything to do with, is in eyelined, and it was a perfect height, this balcony, and then the door kept open and closing. And then it just went for ages, this one ball before Graham Swan was about to bowl, and there was this bloke, terribly dressed, kind of like looking at me, giving me this big thumbs up, and I was just like, sit down. Anyway, got out next ball. I've missed a straight one. I'll have you know. And then sat down, and I was sitting there, you know, kind of lamenting the fact that I've missed this chance to get 100, and will I ever get another one? And I was watching the replays, and then they showed this picture of this bloke giving this thumbs up in terrible clothes. And sure enough, it was my opening partner at Pran Cricket Club, Dan Salpietro. So I kind of said, that's Dan Salpietro. And I think Kate Hutchison was the media manager, and she kind of heard. And next thing you know, this is spread like wildfire, and Salpie's getting interviews on Fox Sports, you know, and all these kind of things. And it was brilliant. Anyway, I got out of the day. You don't get your phones until after. And I just gave him the most ruthless message, you bastard, you know, all this kind of thing. Yeah. And he should have seen this message he gave. Oh, I'm so sorry, mate. You know, it didn't really affect it, did it? No, mate, I just missed a straight one.
So you just I just want to pick up on something completely separate there. You said you don't get your phones at the end of the day. So, like, is there a strict valuables bag in the Australian?
Yeah. I heard that one with Ed, yeah. Well, I always thought that too, isn't that? If you hand it in, it's just easier for someone to pick them up, you know. And,
I'm sure, and the score is not
really,
theory.
The score really doesn't double as a security guard, does he? So, your average scorer anyway. So,
make you give your phones in.
Yeah, well, it's all about the betting, the match fixing stuff these days.
Right.
So
that's not funny.
I think it's any time it's televised. So, a nightmare because. You watch it now. No one really plays cards anymore or things like that when it rains. If you kind of finish the day, you'll actually sit down. You just watch when they get their phones back, and no one's talking, and they're just all on their phones catching up on messages.
Of course, that would happen. I want to talk a little bit about punditry as well. You know, like you are to my mind, and again, I'm being sycophantic here, but like comfortably the best. Ex-player commentator on the game out there. I'm curious about how players make that move. I think about like Gary Neville in football. I don't know if you're familiar with Premier League and stuff as well. Do you put a lot into it, like behind the scenes, into your comments or your stories or the way you kind of articulate your views on the game?
Well, firstly, that's big praise. If you go on social media, that's not what always you get.
I go on social media.
No, actually, I don't. I've had this conversation with Jared Whateley, who, you know, for listeners know, he's this unbelievable broadcaster who prepares so well. And I kind of just said to him one time, I just like to do it a little bit off the cuff, you know. I like to kind of get in and talk about what I see and what springs to mind. And then you tend to not hold back as much, I find. So I don't. I try. You try to give an opinion without being too bad, but it's been enjoyable. In the end, you're watching cricket and you're talking about cricket. What a life!
Mm. You said something really interesting the other day that I wanted to ask you about. You were talking about talent, like this concept of talent the other day, and like what it means. And I was interested in something you said about how the Australian selectors at the moment often, or maybe not at the moment, maybe for a long time, they often pick players on one great thing they've done rather than look at what they normally do. Like, what did you mean by that?
Yeah, I just think there was always the golden child syndrome, you know. You see a guy who plays an unbelievable innings and you think, oh, well, this guy's got the game. He's going to go and make it, you know. But what they fail to see is that it kind of takes them a while to get into that state. And in the meantime, you know, that they'll miss out three or four times. And they won't just miss out. They'll get like under five or whatever. And it's a kind of burden to the side. So I tend to try and look at guys who still contribute even when they're not performing at their best. And yeah, that talent's an interesting one. I mean, is it how well you hit a cover drive, or is it how well you make decisions? If you're trying to cover drive a good length ball that's nipping away, you're going to nick it. So yeah, it's that kind of dilemma that what do you select, and it's been an interesting one for the selectors at the moment.
Mm. Just on a completely separate note, this is this interview is a big privilege for me, obviously because of who you are, but also like, I'm colorblind.
All right,
and you know you are like the
how do you go with the pink ball?
Well, never good enough to know. But like, I found out I was colorblind at like age 22. And I was playing higher grade cricket. And once I found out I was colorblind, as in officially, like I always had been, obviously.
Yeah.
Net sessions became a bit harder. Because I was like, I'm colorblind. I can't see it. There's no sight screen.
Yeah.
Now you are the.
Which surprises me because look at the color of your shirt you've got on, you know. Like I tend to.
I dress my best. Yeah. Yeah. Well, once I found out I was colorblind, my mum said, oh, that makes sense, actually, look, judging by some of your color choices. But, like, how long have you known you were colorblind for? And like, do you legitimately think it affected your ability to play cricket? This answer is important because this kind of sums up my whole career.
I reckon it comes in as a good excuse at times, yeah. So, and when I drop catches side on, I always blame, you know, like the trees, the imaginary trees behind that kind of stuff. But in the end, you kind of, you adapt and you get used to it.
What sort of colorblindness are you? Red-green? Or like full?
Yeah, red-green. Although, yeah. The coach, Andrew Walton, asked me to give this at Pran Cricket Club, asked me to give this masterclass about hitting when I'd just come back from my kind of poor stint at T20 stint at the Thunder, where I capped and we lost all eight games, but that's another story. I stood there and I was trying to teach people about hitting, even though I had no idea what I was talking about. But there's a big brick building in behind. I reckon I was bowled about 10 balls. I laid bat on one of them. So, yeah.
And that's what you could say. You're just like, look at
yeah, I did. I blame it. And it was dark. Yeah.
Okay. We move on to the part of the interview, Chris, where we give you a few throwdowns. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but basically the questions are probably more about us than you. The other guys have written some stuff in. There's not as many as there usually are, but we'll kick off anyway. So just answer them as quickly as you can. And some of the questions are a bit long.
25 words or less. Yeah,
Okay, great. Yeah. Okay. So this is from Dave. And just bear with it. Yeah. No. I should have asked him, actually. We always ask for anonymous questions. Anyway. This is from Dave, from The Great Cricketer. He says, Australia has a grand history of odd couple opening partners, Slater-Taylor, Hayden Langer, and, of course, Rogers Warner. David Warner once described the two of you as two different people, as in he reads a lot of books. I wouldn't read a book. He is on his Kindle, but I'm on my iPhone looking at news. Does David know that Facebook is not a news site, or was he clicking on those fake news articles that swept Trump into office?
Do I need to answer that one? Yeah. What do you say about Davey inside 25 words? That's the tough one.
Well, he's the Reverend now, isn't he? I mean, he's been coached by an aerobics all-star
instructor.
Yeah, but
I think he's had three personalities in the last 2 years, so there's got to be a forthcoming.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I wonder what's the next incarnation of the Warner brand, you know what I mean? It's good. It's good. Anyway, look, I'll move to the next one. This is from Dave as well. On Twitter, you describe yourself in your bio as short, short-sighted, colorblind, redhead. Do you have any other physical / genetic shortcomings you'd like to make public? For example, were you tempted to slip with small hands in at the end of that bio just to cap things off? How do you answer that? I'm the messenger.
I listened to your one where Bob Quiney likes to go and shower with random showers in cricket change rooms. And
There was more to that than we're able to let on.
Yeah.
On air.
He said, you know, either you're happy or you're not. He said he usually wasn't, but, you know, I'll leave it at that one.
Okay. Chris, I kind of asked you this earlier, but I want a more elaborate answer from you. You've scored 5 test hundreds, 14 50s, 25,000 first-class runs for multiple teams, played over 300 matches, and now you commentate every Australian test match. How much do you hate cricket?
As I said, it gives me this chance to enjoy myself without having to have a 9-to-5 job. So, look, I love the game and what it's given me. So, without trying to be funny, wouldn't change it for anything.
Now, you were telling me off air, this isn't a throwdown question, that your parents own a cricket ground. Would you say up in Seymour or something? So
yeah,
maybe describe
Seymour,
where
yeah.
Seymour is and
Seymour,
what happens
about
there?
Well, it's about an hour and a half straight up the Hume Highway, north of Melbourne, and there's a cricket ground there called, it used to be called the Hume and Hovell Cricket Ground, and my parents did the Grey Nomad just before the 13 Ashes, and then I got the call up, so they had to kind of, shorten this trip. But anyway, someone said, go have a look at this ground there, and they found out it was for sale, and they ended up buying it, and it's they've loved it, yeah. There's just kind of having this private cricket ground where you have corporate games, you know, yeah. some grade pre-season games, weddings, bucks do. Actually, I was coming back from England, and I was coming through immigration, and a guy just stopped and said, I know you. And I was like, oh, okay. And he said, yeah, you're John Rogers' son, aren't you? And I was like, oh. He said, yeah, we had a bucks do up at your
things. Oh,
and my old man apparently got involved, as of course he did, and yeah. And gave him a big speech about W.G. Grace. So there you go.
How good's that? So your old man played first-class cricket as well, didn't he?
Yeah, played 5 games, yep. For New South Wales, yeah.
So did he grow up there as well? Is there some Sydney element to you?
Oh, he was from Gosford.
Gosford, right.
Yeah, the kind of central coast. There are stories of him hitchhiking for 2 hours to go play at Newcastle, you know, each way when he was about 19. And so yeah, he loved the game as well. And his brother, Derek, my late uncle, he was a legend through the Riverina area at Wagga Wagga.
Right, but obviously you're the best player in the family.
Well, according to Jeff Lawson, actually, Derek, my uncle, was the best of all, so okay. There you go.
Jeff Lawson would say that. Channel 9 commentators were recently postulating that players on field style usually reflected their personality. They also said on air that you, Chris Rogers, were an exception. It was an exception to that. Many others also tell me that you're loose. How do you respond to that? I'm not really sure what you're supposed to say to
yeah,
this,
I'd,
most of these
yeah.
questions, but, you know, how loose are you?
Loose-ish. I'm not sure how you want me to answer that one. I do remember listening to the commentary when I scored my 100 at Sydney, and there's Ian Healy kind of saying how much of a different bloke I am off the field and stuff like that, so...
How good is that term different
yes,
in cricket? You're a
yes.
different bloke.
Yeah, got that a lot actually. But
really?
I like to enjoy myself. Is
yes.
that? I'm not sure where to go with that one.
Well, you know, it's a really selfish question like most of these are. It's really about the question. I mean, why don't we just leave it at that?
Well, the Emerson Hotel is about 100 metres from
it.
My place,
right.
So I tend to kind of end up there every now and again.
Okay, Emerson Hotel. I just have three words for this question. Describe your dancing.
Energetic.
This is the most serious you've looked for any of these questions I've asked you. You've focused.
Yeah. Enjoyable and outstanding. There you go.
Energetic, enjoyable, outstanding.
But I will say that. Well, I had a bit of a dance-off with Petey Hanscom the other day, and I do believe I came out on top, but that might be disputed.
Okay, sorry. I have to follow up on that. Yeah. Like, you had a bit of a dance-off with Petey Hanscom, so can you please... You're an ABC broadcaster. Can you please paint that scene for the listeners?
Well, the day-night test matches is you can't... There's no, when the game finishes, if it finishes at the end of the day... ABC can't fly you home and save on, you know, on a hotel that night. So we had to stay and hello to the ABC. And then we ended up kind of socializing with the Aussie guys. Kadich and I were lucky enough to get invited into the rooms for a bit. And then we went out and we had a pretty good time. So there was a little bit of dancing. I'm too old
set
for
up
it now.
Someone's...
I'm too old. I'm way too old for it now. But, you know, when you've had a few And there's Petey enjoying himself, and I'd like to think I taught him a thing or two. You can't help yourself, so there you go.
Of course. So just, sorry to zero in on this, but like I'm imagining now a circle. Like there's a circle, there's maybe...
Oh, we were kind of
Mitch,
off to the
Mitch
side.
Stark, and someone's just gone, it's Buck versus Hank.
Pete Neville versus the other one. Pete Neville.
Right, okay.
I've seen him. He's exceptional. He can kind of do the Michael Jackson...
Well, he plays electric guitar, doesn't he? He's a guitarist.
He does all sorts of weird things. He puts.
He's a different bloke too. Is he?
Yeah, different. Right. Yeah, puts things in his ears when he goes out. I don't know if they're fake or not. So, but yeah, he's a great bloke. He's funny.
Also, he puts like what little earplugs in his ears when he goes out the back just to protect his ears for his musicianship.
No. You know, like in your earlobe where you put the ones in that kind of. I think you can have fake ones, can't you? I wouldn't have a clue. Too cool for us.
Yeah. Okay. So he did he ever play any teams? Yeah, you would have played with Pete Neville. I mean, did he ever bust out his guitar or anything, or just start wailing a couple of tunes after a win or anything? Just solo?
Nah, that was Shane Watson.
Right.
He loved it.
Was he good? Is he good at guitar, Shane Watson?
Yeah, he was. He was good when.
So Jason Crazier's good. He's a good guitarist.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. He's loose as well. There you go.
Yeah, he was. This is the loose 11. This is what I'm talking about.
Yeah. He won't mind me saying that though. What's the cavern in Liverpool? I remember. You can get up and play.
Oh, that's where
your
the Beatles
guitar.
Play.
Yeah. And you can get up and play your guitar and Watto got up and played there. He was exceptional. And after we won the Ashes in Sydney, we won inside 3 days, and then we went to. I forget this guy's name every time. Owns the Ivy. Justin
Hems.
Yeah, we went to his place and
talk about a Sydney flavour. Anyway,
that was one of the best days of my life. Watto got the guitar out again, and he was fantastic.
That's good. That's good. I'd love to know more about the dance-offs there, but I don't think we have time. Just a final question. This is from Higos. He just says, can I have some gloves?
I've got no gear left. I was never a hoarder either. I just always got the basic amount of bats and kind of used whatever I was given. So, I haven't got much gear left. Sorry.
Really? Yeah. Oh, no, okay. Well, we always ask. So far, we've had no gear from anybody. McGill doesn't have any.
Ed said you can go and pick it up at some place on Oxford. That's Oxford right. Street.
That's a good point, actually. You can go to the Salvos and all of his New South Wales kits there.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, just an immense privilege to have you on the show. I think. As I said earlier, you know, a cricketer that like we can all relate to, which I think is, you know, testament to how excellent you are, how excellent your career was, but also like how accessible you are as a person as well. And, you know, wishing you the best for your broadcasting career as well. And just, you know, please keep talking to us about cricket because there's not enough ex-players who just, you know, who are honest and nice to listen to.
No, I appreciate it. I read the book, I told you, and I remember I was in the UK reading the Grey Cricketer book. It'd be about 1 o'clock at night, and I'd just be laughing, bursting into tears with some of the bits in there.
I cried. Yeah.
The toss and then the game out the back at Christmas. You know, the family game. That was hilarious. It's been a pleasure to come on.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and you know, to your credit, you did. You are one of the people who often well, not often, but you've written to us via DMs on Twitter, and a couple of other storied Australian players do that as well, and tell us a few stories on the condition of anonymity. So, you know, if there's anything else you want to write to us that we can tweet out.
I think I asked whether when you were doing your second book. But
yeah, that's right.
My other bit about that was, before you kicked me off, was Ed Cowan asking the question about listing. I think it was getting you guys to rate your books from Gideon's Stroke of Genius down to Chris Rogers bucking the trend. So I can't. That probably means mine's the worst of the lot.
Like he really positions himself as the intellectual cricketer. Although I understand, and this might not make sense to the listeners, but I mean, we've got Ryan Carter's coming on the show tonight. I think he might be up next in the show, and he's meant to be the smartest guy in cricket above Ed Cowan.
All right, yeah.
Is that true?
He's brilliant, yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. But yeah.
But that's a bit harsh from Ed. I would have thought yours.
But he did. He texted me and said how much he enjoyed the book. So, you know, what am I supposed to take from that?
Cowan. No, he was very good. Thanks for joining the show, Chris. Hopefully we'll have you on again.
Good on you.
This summer, we've got the biggest renovation challenge yet. Two teams will have to transform not one, but two broken down grade cricket dressing rooms every single week. There will be tension.
What even is grade cricket, Dazza? Why do we take time off work to do this?
Come on, Charlesy, work hard, love.
There will be drama.
I just want to make this perfect. Great cricket deserves a great home.
But when the reveal comes, there will be joy.
Oh, God. Lads, boys, look at this, right? Results.
Ever since the missus booted me out and took the kids, I've been sleeping in this dressing room. It's a second home to me, literally. So this is really special.
For us to be able to come in and give these grade cricketers a beautiful new dressing room, one they can drink their beers in, sing the club song, judge each other in the showers. Yeah, you know, it makes you feel good.
But this ain't no charity. Not when the stakes are this high.
I'm not here for a bloody holiday. I mean, if I wanted that, I would have gone to Bali or Thailand.
It's Australia's toughest renovation competition. Winner takes all.
If I have to dish out a little bit of chin music, I will.
Presented by Australia's favourite knockabout blue-collared larrikin millionaire.
We're giving great cricket the reno makeover it deserves.
Reno Rampage, coming soon.
So we had Gideon Hay last week. We had Chris Rogers this week. Ed Cowan several weeks back. Now in the final instalment of our ongoing series with cricket's leading intellectuals, we're very pleased to welcome New South Wales and Sydney Sixers player Ryan Carter's to the podcast. Welcome, mate.
Thanks, guys. Great to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. Did you ride your bike here is what I want to know, because I know that you're a very carbon conscious man.
No, but I caught public transport. I got a bus down from St. Leonard's. And the funny thing is I actually got champed by the bus driver. I thought that was very appropriate. I stepped onto the bus, back door, Opel car, ding.
Yeah.
Bus driver stares at me in the rear vision mirror. Did you tap on, mate?
Tap on?
Yeah. It's like, yeah, I tapped on. Well, did it work? I was like, I think so. And suddenly I've got like everyone on the aisle seat staring at me like I'm some petty criminal.
Six people trying to get off behind you.
And then this kid opposite me sticks up for me. He goes, yeah, he tapped on. I saw it. So it's like when the batsman at the other end tells the bowler, get back to your mark, mate. Yeah. Leave this guy alone.
They're never short on a champing, are they, the bus drivers?
I love a champing.
They hold all the cards.
Them and baristas, like, they're very big on it. Yeah. I mean, that's probably as close as I'll ever get to fame when like just that many people are looking at you.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when like you smash onto the keep and you don't walk. Everyone looks at you. You hit that, didn't you? You go, yeah, I hit it, yeah. But I've already paid my fee. So as close as you're going
to
get.
Well, he's gone home to his family and said, today I champ Ryan Carter. So he's the ultimate winner.
All I could think about it is that, mate, you could have been a great third grader.
You got it, mate. Now, look, Carter, you're the youngest guest we've ever had on this podcast, which is slightly intimidating in a different way than usual for us. You've already achieved a lot of great things at quite a tender age. But it is tradition for us to kick things off the same way every week, because you know, we have a deep-seated fear of change. Mm. So tell us a little bit about your relationship to grade cricket, and we'll go from there.
Well, I might tell you where it started. That's probably the best way. So I signed up for Western District University of Canberra Cricket Club when I was, I think, 14-year-old boy in Canberra. First week, got picked in sixth grade. Didn't even get to play on turf, synthetic wicket. Leave your spikes at home. I thought these guys, to be honest, looked like they hadn't played much cricket in their life. Yeah. But I walked out there and got a golden duck.
Yeah.
Embarrassed myself. Picked in third grade next week. I think I got the front end of the wave of youth hysteria that was sweeping Australian cricket at the time.
Half your age plus seven.
Yeah. And then I rocked up to third grade the next week in my whites for the warm-up. And the guys just couldn't, you know, in stitches laughing. I didn't understand why. Yeah. And that was the beginning of being bullied for years to come, really.
Yeah, yeah. And it doesn't show. You know, you seem well-adjusted now, but you know, you obviously were tormented by those early days in sixth grade.
Yeah, sixth grade into the harsh environment of third grade straight away. I feel like fifth and fourth would have prepared me socially.
Yeah.
So it was a tough jump. Oh, and then, of course, at the end of the day, I got fined in my first ever fines meeting for showing up.
How old were you?
14.
14. You got fined.
You're at a fines committee hearing at 14.
Who's the sociopath who's going, oh, I've been waiting all week to get this bloke. He's 14, mate.
Yeah, I'm going to cash his pocket money at the pub.
So I got fined for showing up to the ground in whites, wicket-keeping in short sleeves.
Yep.
Two classic errors, but I wasn't to know.
Yeah.
So I had to use my pocket money to pay the fine.
Well, I mean, we speak about something Dave said before. We have a deep-seated fear of change, but you clearly don't. I mean, being raised in Canberra, you studied cricket career in Canberra. Then you were in Victoria, and then you found yourself behind current Australian wicketkeeper Matt Wade, and then moved to New South Wales. You've sort of been around the eastern coast so far. So, I mean, the obvious question is: any chance to move to Brisbane next?
Well, yeah, I might try everything out for a couple of years. No, I actually love playing here in New South Wales. At the time when I made that change, I think it was a really great decision, and I was welcomed immediately by the New South Wales group, which was awesome and helped me to have a great year in that first season.
And you're a Sydney Uni cricketer.
That's right. Yep.
So like playing for the most prestigious grade cricket club going around Sydney Test Cricket.
Oh, kind of you to say that, Dave. it's awesome. Like, what about Greg Mayle, the stalwart at Sydney Uni? Yeah.
He's still around.
He's made nearly 50 first grade hundreds now.
Yeah.
He's just breaking records.
Yeah. He made his millionth run last week. Yeah.
Did he?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, million. Yeah.
Was there a little ticker going on the scoreboard, just ticking over?
Yeah, yeah.
I've never seen someone with a higher runs to words ratio as a cricketer.
Right.
Like, it's unbelievable. He averages 60 in first grade and averages 20 words a day.
Obviously it's that time of year again when the Big Bash comes around, and that's something that you're intrinsically involved in, and that's something that our international listeners will be interested in as well. We've got a lot of people from the UK who tune in each week, and they love the Big Bash. Tell us what being around the Big Bash squad has been like for you, it's grown so much over the last few years, hasn't it?
Yeah, the growth of the Big Bash has been pretty crazy. It's really changed our identities as lowly domestic cricketers, because suddenly we get to play in front of stadiums full of people and everyone's watching at home on TV. And
yeah, what's that like? Tell us everything. What's it like to be good?
Well, it's weird because, you know, 2 weeks ago, so last night we played at a sellout crowd at Spotless Stadium in the Sydney Thunder versus Sixers, and 2 weeks ago it was all the same players at the Adelaide Oval playing in Sheffield Shield, and no one cared.
Yeah.
No one shows up. You know,
it's just the branding, isn't it? The colours.
Yeah.
It's just colours. Yeah, it's colours. Yeah.
So if you market anything right, it looks good.
Yeah. Can we talk about? Dave and I will speak about the Big Bash later on. But Andre Russell's bat. It was an all black bat for people playing at home. What were the thoughts of the players when they saw Andre Russell walk out to bat in an all black bat with an all black bat?
We actually, you know, those warm-up bats that are made of foam?
Yeah.
The first thing I thought was, holy shit, he's walking out with a warm-up bat.
He's just picked up the wrong bat.
But I don't know. I guess it's just a marketing stunt. And, you know, tellingly, it's done exactly what it was meant to do.
Yeah.
Even though it's been banned, I think, now 24 hours later by Cricket Australia.
Right.
They've probably got a million or more social media views.
You know,
it's blowing up on every news station, even the Subversive Grade Cricketer podcast.
I'm just facilitating all of that. So I just want to ask you, you touched on something there before about how, a couple of weeks ago, the state players were playing in front of, you know, nobody, not even their dads were showing up. That was a story that went around last week.
And it wasn't. I just made that up. And I want to know what it's like as a state player to. I mean, this BBL is like an interruption almost in the middle of the season, isn't it? Like the season's so fragmented. You start off with the Matador Cup and you play all the one day games, and then you go into like a Shield season. Then you break for a few weeks and play the Big Bash, and then you go back to playing some Shield cricket afterwards. Is it frustrating to not have any momentum into a season?
No, I actually like that. I like that setup. It's like you're playing one tournament at a time.
Yeah,
okay. We used to go 4 day into 1 day into 4 day into 1 day, and for me that was a bit fragmented. But it is a strange time this time of year when you suddenly switch from the blue of New South Wales to the magenta of the Sixers. And it's like somehow everything goes to a new level. It's like because there's a lot more attention on the Big Bash, suddenly we have to be really intense and act like we're all big dog professional players instead of just like the same blokes who were taking the piss out of each other, you know, in the warm up. Yeah. Everyone's like super uptight.
There's just so much money in it, isn't there? There's so many sponsors everywhere. There's a lot at stake. And do you feel that going out there?
Yeah, I think you do. That's what I mean. It's like feels really high stakes. And I think I've heard like staff around cricket administration sort of joke about it. Like as soon as BBL's on, it's like everything else is off. This is like the holy grail. This is the most important thing.
And
obviously from the traditionalists, there's a bit of backlash. Like, well, the Sheffield Shield's the most important thing. And let's get this gimmick out of the way and concentrate on the real stuff again.
I think like the purest point of view, like, I mean, everyone who loves cricket loves test cricket. But there is something that's amazingly exciting about the Big Bash. Maybe it's the time of year it's on as well. Everyone's off work. You know, middle of summer, Christmas, that kind of stuff. I mean, the players must actually like really love thousands of people each week. I mean, the average last year was like 30,000 people turning up.
It's in the top 10 most attended leagues in the world out of all sports.
Yeah.
So AFL is like fourth. I think Big Bash is eighth or ninth. So it gets big numbers.
Yeah.
And of course, you get to use the alliteration of Big Bash
kind of over and over again. Really nearly, that's right.
I mean, my question to you is that, mate, the players must be as excited as the punters going through the gates, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, no, we absolutely are. Like, as I said, it's amazing for players who never make it to international cricket, but play first class level. Suddenly, you get a chance to play in front of big crowds and have those really exciting moments and perhaps that kind of public triumph that you'd probably always dreamed of as a kid.
Always.
I guess we would like to talk to you today a bit about your charity, Batting for Change. It's a big part of the Big Bash, actually, every year. And I know that last night, or Tuesday night, for those listeners who might be catching up with this podcast, that was the start of the Big Bash and the start of Batting for Change's involvement in the Big Bash. Can you just tell us a little bit about the charity that you launched and tell us who it's for and kind of how it works?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's called Batting for Change, and I founded it 3 years ago in partnership with the LBW Trust. They're an existing charity in Sydney, and they support education for disadvantaged young people around the cricket-playing world. And I came to them with an idea. How about we try and raise money using the Big Bash League, which is, as discussed, skyrocketing in popularity, and ask people to log on to battingforchange.com.au and make a pledge for every six my team hits. So at the time that was Sydney Thunder, now obviously it's the Sydney Sixers. And so people would log on, sure enough, I'll give $1 per six, and then at the end of the tournament, if we'd hit 47 sixes, we'll get in touch and say, hey, can you pay us $47, please? And I really didn't know if it was going to be successful or not at the time. I just wanted to do something because I was really confronted by the inequality I'd seen often traveling around the world on cricket trips. I think it's probably particularly highlighted when you're in that situation because you're there as like a sports person, and then, but just outside the stadium, you know, for example, the slums of Chennai or Mumbai, where literally millions of people are living on less than a dollar per day. And it's just, I don't think you can really stop and sort of put your life on hold for 5 minutes and reflect on that and not feel like you want to do something because it's just fundamentally not right. So it's not about turning your life around and thinking, okay, you know, I have to be Mother Teresa, but I think it's about, well, what's a realistic way I can contribute in a small way? So we've tried to create a platform for that so people can have fun, watch the Big Bash, have a joke with their mates. Oh no, I just lost another $5. Thanks to this carts bloke. But, but you know, on the other hand, they know it's going to women's education and trying to level that playing field and give these girls an opportunity that they wouldn't otherwise have.
I mean, it's been amazingly successful. I mean, perhaps even more successful than what you had anticipated or even hoped for. I mean, was it 13, 14, there was $30,000 raised for the Nepalese women, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, did you have any sort of monetary goals, a number in mind, a figure, or was he just kind of putting it out there and just seeing how it went? Because, I mean, it's gone from strength to strength since then.
We did actually set 30,000 as our goal that year, and we managed to get it spot on. So I don't know if that was just serendipity or good planning, but that's how it worked out. And then the following year, we raised over 100,000, and then last year, 140,000. So our goal this summer is 150,000, which would be more than we've ever raised. And in particular, I'm really excited about launching a new project for women in Kenya who've grown up in a rural village, have just finished their high school education, which is almost unprecedented in their village. But let alone that, a few of them are really keen to go to university. So from 35,000 of this 150,000 is going to go towards this group of women to be the first, some of the first ever from their village to go to university.
I mean, it's amazing. And I'm gobsmacked in a lot of ways because... I mean, it's awesome that you can just come on and speak about these things because, you know, a lot of time we take the piss out of everything. A lot of the time, all the time, that's what podcast is. So, I mean, it's amazing to hear about you talking about these things that are so important and so passionately as well. This venture into Kenya is, I mean, it's a little bit different to the stuff you're doing in India. It's almost delving into like social activism in a way. Would you agree with that?
I'd say it's got an additional angle. The additional angle is to do with female genital mutilation and child marriage, because both of those things are very common in this particular part of Kenya. It's in the Maasai community. And the woman, Kikenya Natala, who founded this project over there, she makes it a condition of these women receiving this education that they will not be genitally mutilated and they won't be married until the age of 18. So it's a great way of, I guess, fighting those two evils at the same time of creating the good of women's education.
So in terms of people who want to support Batting for Change and they might want to donate to the cause, how can they kind of get in touch with you or the organisation?
Yeah, absolutely. It's all online at battingforchange.com.au. It literally takes 30 seconds to make a pledge. You go, my name's Ryan Carters and I'll give you $5 for every six you hit this year, or $1 or 50 cents. You know, all donations, great and small, do go a long way.
I think the grade cricket fraternity could reach out to Batting for Change. I mean,
yeah,
there's a lot of money going through the fines system at grade cricket.
That's true.
Instead of towards end of season piss-ups, maybe you could put it into something a bit more worthwhile this year.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people buying second pairs of batting gloves that they'll never need because they've never batted more than 15 minutes in a match. So why spend $120 on a pair of grey nickels when you can actually support people in need instead of thinking about yourself, you selfish prick.
That's right.
Loyal listener.
Just go for a second tier brand.
We'd love if you stick around for the next segment. We'll take some questions from the grade cricketer social media audience and we'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Absolutely.
Big day?
No, big night. I've got to clean up the last two wickets, sing the song, do the covers, sing the song, drink 42 beers in the sheds, have a shower, sing the song, publicly objectify my teammates' rigs, compare sizes, tell everyone how good I was when I was 17, go to a strip club, lie to my wife, then spend all of Sunday being an emotionally absent father and husband. Big nights start with grade cricket. Lying to yourself has never been harder.
Lads, it's that time of the week where we answer your questions, you being the grade cricketer audience. Thank you for sending those in. You can always do so with the hashtag AskTGC via Twitter or via Facebook. This one comes from Kieran Purnell. He says, my father, as I will hear again on Christmas Day, played grade cricket with a number of international players. He was apparently good mates with one-time International Cricketer of the Year, Bruce Yardley. Mr. Yardley came to our house for dinner a number of times and once called my off-spinner to my eight-year-old cousin unplayable. He would also give Dad members tickets to the tests in Melbourne. One day, Dad told me to mind our members' seats and he took my sister into the Australian dressing room. I left the seats and peered through the window at my father and sister meeting the Australian players. Was 20 years of persistent mediocrity in park cricket and my sister's lifelong brand loyalty to Benson and Hedges a proportional response on our behalf? Or as I am beginning to suspect, some sort of father-son Machiavellian power play. So he's not scarred by this at all.
No, it's been 20 years and he's barely talking about it on social media in front of 30,000 people on Facebook. But where does one begin?
Cuts. Ryan.
Reasonable trade-off, really. I mean, 20 years of your life, but an opportunity to watch a Boxing Day test at the members. Peer through the window in an Australian dressing room.
Yeah. Does anyone have Bruce Yardley's number? He's just flicking away Boxing Day members tickets.
I love the respect he's given to Mr. Yardley. Mr. Like, he had like a full relationship with him. It's now very 1960s.
That sounds problematic to me still.
I mean, what? I mean, why was his sister invited into the Australian team's dressing room? Now, I don't know much about, you know, cricket in the 1980s, but I'm going to guess that it wasn't really a child-friendly zone. I would like to get Kieran Purnell's sister's angle on this.
Yeah. I think we need
what she
to.
Saw. I mean,
well, the things she would have seen, unspeakable
horrors
in those change rooms. I mean, horrors. I mean, the dad probably realised that he was already dining out on his Bruce Yardley anecdote of fooling his cousin with an off spinner, all those years ago. So he thought, well, even the ledger will bring this. You know, my daughter can join me in this wonderful moment and experience, this wonderful moment of cricket.
Well, I'd like to speak to Mr. Purnell about batting for change because it sounds like he's all about women's education and empowerment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Some great synergies going here on the Grey Cricketer podcast.
Battingforchange.com.au. Next question comes from Graham Batty. And this is one of my favourite ones of the week because it's a true story. Recently, a Sydney Grey cricketer was sacked after it was found out he was doctoring the scorebook and changing his bowling figures to make them look better. Is this a sackable offence from a cricket club or prison time? I'll let you boys decide. Graham, interesting question. So this is actually a true story because I chased Graham up and I said, Graham, is this real? And he said, yes. I won't name the club because that's not necessary, but it is a real thing.
Okay.
And it's a third grader.
Right, so of course, a young third grader.
Just the middle of everything. Yeah. So he's a young third grader in Sydney Test cricket. And he's changing his bowling figures. Karts, have you ever come across this in your life?
Have you ever considered this in your darker moments?
Yeah. No. I mean, I've heard when I played in England when I was 18, a guy started dating the scorer.
Right.
That's the same thing. It was a woman.
And, yeah, and whose wife was it?
It was reasonable to assume he was angling for some doctored bowling results.
Oh, yeah.
As well as a long-term relationship.
Yeah, hopefully both came to fruition. I mean, it's a victimless crime, isn't it? Because the data, I presume, has already been entered into MyCricket by then. So what's the point of it, is what I'm saying.
Well, what's the difference between... I mean, we've all done it as a thought crime, haven't we?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And absolutely, talking later in the pub that night, we've all done it. Mm-hmm. So I guess, is there a difference? It's a bit of an Orwellian theme here, between the thought and the actual action, or have you already committed the crime?
Yeah, it feels all very Watergate, doesn't it? In some way, I haven't thought that through at all, but but is this a sackable offence from a cricket club? I don't know. No? Yes?
No.
It's not prison time.
It's not prison time. It's not prison time.
Home detention, maybe, but not prison time.
Yeah, weekend detention.
Selection in general across the middle grades, I think it's age dependent. I think if he's under 25, benefit of the doubt. If he's over 25,
he's only a minor.
It's probably goodbye.
Yeah. Good behaviour. All right. This next one comes from Tom Guy. And this is a pretty interesting one, actually. He says, my wife told me to change my son's nappy in a pub in London. In the absence of changing facilities, I had to put him in the only sink in the gents. Halfway through, he started pissing everywhere, all over me, all over him. Spanish-looking bloke comes out of the... He's got some writing skills, this bloke. Spanish-looking bloke comes out of the cubicle, unable to wash his hands as we're blocking his path. Immediately, he says, good luck with that, champ. Now, was he alphaing me, or is he genuinely sympathetic? And is this champ or champ... Is this champ or be champ thing, which I hadn't come across until the Grade Cricketer, widely applicable in other cultures. Now, Ryan, you've got a lot of experience with other cultures.
Yeah.
Does the champ or be champ philosophy transcend Australian Grade Cricket culture into the offshore?
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, there's a different word for it, but it's universal, isn't it?
Yeah.
We saw it. It's on buses in Northern Sydney. We learned that today on my way here. I think there's not a culture in the world that doesn't champ or be champ.
Absolutely. I wonder, what's the campeón? Is that the Spanish word for champ?
Yeah.
I have to check with our Spanish listeners.
That's actually how the champs Delice got its name. Someone, someone champed its Delice.
Very good.
So the question was Tom being Alfred in that environment was his question.
Well, I think as a rule of thumb, if you're asking, am I being Alfred? You're being Alfred. It's similar to gambling. It's like, do I have a problem? Yes, you have a problem.
Yeah. You've always got a problem if you have to ask. I mean, I think the bloke has seen that Tom is struggling here and he's tried to be nice. I don't think he's champing you in the traditional sense that, the cordon chirping away at you as you've played and missed for the eighth consecutive delivery.
Yeah.
It's more of a friendly kind of... I mean, I know that champ is essentially... always seen as a derogatory kind of term. Not, it's the opposite of a term of endearment,
Yes.
But it can come as, I guess, faux endearment as well. Mm. Like, say you made like an ugly 15 and then nicked off to Gully, then you walk off and your teammate says, great effort, champ. Mm. Yep. Is it endearment? Well, yes, but it's also highly condescending.
You go crazy thinking of all the levels.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it benevolent? Is it belligerent? Ned Weatherly writes in on the old FB as well. He said, hey guys, love the show. Here is a question for the podcast. I've represented Australia in athletics in hammer throw, arrogant, but my dad once made back-to-back centuries while batting number three and keeping in premier cricket. Who is the alpha in this relationship?
I think we've discovered that Australians have an obsession with alpha and beta relationship.
And father issues. Isn't father issues the great... Well, I mean, Karts, I feel like without putting words in your mouth, I think you've answered the question. If you have to ask who is the alpha in this relationship, it's not you.
Yeah. Your dad's not asking that question, is he?
No. Your dad's got tons in premier cricket.
Yeah. He's just having a beer at the pub, champing blokes left, right and centre.
All right, we've got one here from Greg Powell. Mm. Another longish one, he says, and it's a good anecdote.
Yep.
I played fourth grade with Rob Quiney, friend of the show. In one game, he got out before me and we were in a bit of trouble, or as he says, froth and bubble. I then bizarrely overheard first slip saying, this bloke, referring to me, is the only bloke who's shown anything. Possibly the first case of reverse sledging in grade premier cricket, so I promptly nicked the next ball straight to him. A decade and a half on, I feel satisfied that I was once considered a better batsman than a test player. I never played higher than third grade. Is it okay for me to continue to use this story amongst those with some knowledge of the game? Cuts. Is he okay to continue this anecdote?
Yeah.
I think the key phrase there is some knowledge of the game. I think very low level knowledge.
Yeah.
Absolutely ride that for all it's worth.
So at Christmas, should he be saying this? Christmas is coming.
It's around the corner.
Anyone who's played anything above a year 10D sort of level of cricket, I'd be very hesitant to use that.
I love the reverse sledging. I've experienced it myself. I'm not sure if you have, he goes, but it's obviously designed to make you feel bad.
Yes.
But it had the reverse effect on me. I thought, you know, maybe I am good. maybe I have shown something. In this case, it's obviously rattled him massively, but it's just classic reverse psychology.
So, I mean, Karts, but you would have played in cricket matches with test players playing, and you would have done better than said test players. Like Ed Cowan has played some test matches. He keeps texting us about it. But in some games, you would have played with him and done better than him. So that must make you feel pretty good that you've done better than a test player. But you're good yourself, so I don't know how that works.
I'm
just talking to myself now. Is anyone here?
No one's here. You guys would have scored more runs than first graders sometimes.
Yeah, but playing fifth grade.
Yeah. It's not like.
No, it's not.
No, I mean, you're beginning to sound like my mum now, like comforting me. It's like when I average 30 in another season, she's like, it looks at the scorecard.
God,
oh, but you were the top scorer that day. We got bowled out for 86, mum. Like, I made 22.
What's a...
Yeah, but Stephen Smith didn't go very well.
So do you actually put your average against, like, that kind of thing? Or what's a good average for you? Like, I mean, honestly, what would you feel comfortable and happy with as an average?
Oh.
Would you be, like, satiated?
Well, you remind me, I think 40's good and 30's not quite there. Okay. Mm. And I remember my first game of first grade cricket back in Canberra. Mm. Walked out to bat. ACT cricket head of high performance is there. All right, mate, let's see what you got. Average third at the under 17s last year. That doesn't count for F all now. And yeah, that kind of hurt because he was a bit of a mentor, you know, in my life.
Right.
You know what really hurt? I averaged 40 in that tournament.
And you didn't say that under your breath.
40 and 30, it's a different ball game, isn't it? Isn't it?
40 is almost 50-odd. I'm just putting that there. Last question, and it's an excellent one, from Dan LaFranchi. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that correctly. Almost definitely not. It's on Twitter, but he's taken a screenshot from his notes.
Damien LaFranchi.
Right. Dear TGC, I've not played grade cricket for 11 years, but every year I religiously check the club's records list to see if I still hold the fourth grade, fourth wicket partnership record. The record was set in the 1995-96 season, and was my last real success, if you can call it that, in grade cricket. I secretly hope it never gets bettered and my name is for all eternity etched in grade cricket's record books. Is my pride in this record validated, or am I still harbouring feelings of unfinished business, unfulfilled potential in the grade cricket arena? Damien, current fourth grade, fourth wicket record holder at Sandgate, Redcliffe CC. And he says, PS proof attached. And he's taking a screenshot of the post. Fourth grade.
If he hasn't already contacted them, that's definitely going on his tombstone.
Yeah. Well, I actually looked up his LinkedIn. It's on his LinkedIn as well.
Yeah.
Fourth wicket partnership. It's only 123. So
yeah, that's what I got out of that.
Yeah.
How's it not been broken?
I'm not sure if this is proper great cricket or if this is like...
Nah, it's one of those things where they think it's great cricket, but yeah, it's really bad.
I mean, if the fourth grade, fourth wicket record partnership ever is 123, yeah. Like there's... Well, like,
it's, yeah, it's not Sydney Test cricket.
It's not Sydney Test cricket, Ryan Carter's.
We're talking
it's
Brisbane.
Not.
Yeah. It's not a bad standard.
It feels like Adelaide to me. It feels really...
It's Adelaide, isn't it?
Yeah, it feels where like Sean Tate's batting four and bowling off spin but still taking wickets and scoring runs, yeah.
Well, I think we've answered that for him. Has he been Alfred? We think he has. Thank you to everyone for your questions. That's it for another week on the Great Cricket Podcast. Karts, it's been a pleasure to have you. Chris Rogers was fascinating earlier in the podcast. He goes, great to be with you as always.
It's an absolute pleasure.
Sam will be back with us next week. We look forward to seeing you then.